So we often put forward two points of view, and I have this idea that we come up with two points of view because we've got two hands, you know, like we've got two hands and two legs and two eyes. So we are beings that have one half and the other half. So we often go, oh, there's this one idea and then there's the opposite idea. And that's not really true. There isn't really many cases where there's one thing or the other. There's often a gradient in between. And my big theory is if we were like octopuses or octopi, we would probably not say one hand or the other and come up with two options. We would probably be quite content with coming up with eight because we go, you know, on the one tentacle this and on the one tentacle that and on the other tentacle this. So I like to think that it would be good if instead of saying here's one position and here's the opposite position and that's all there is, wouldn't it be great if we could come up with a whole range of positions along that gradient?
I'm just thinking that, like, if we were cephalopods like that or some other many tentacle thing, wouldn't it take an awfully long time to go sort of on the one tentacle this and on the other tentacle this and then sort of all the way up to what, 8, 10? Seems like a lot of work.
I think it would, because we are the two-handed beings. But if we were born as 8-tentacled, it would be normal. So our conversations would normally include a wider range of options. That's the theory anyway.
It actually reminded me about, I think this is a thing I read from Jerry Weinberg that it seems to have influenced my thinking in ways that are more profound than I actually care to admit at times. But I think that he writes somewhere that when you come to solutioning, he takes this up as if you have only a single option, then that's an ultimatum. And if you end up with the, on the one hand this and on the other hand that, you end up with sort of this dichotomy, then you're actually in a dilemma. Optionality doesn't arise until you sort of go beyond two. So when you reach three, then you sort of, well, then you can actually genuinely claim that you've presented options. So that's sort of his heuristic for it, of how to break free of our bipedalness, I suppose. So I think that there's something very compelling to it, and finding that yeah, of course, we have two hands, so it makes sense. It's almost a bit Sapphire Whorf, isn't it? Language shapes how we think, and sort of, well, the vehicle for thinking is, of course, our physical presence in a way.
I'm amazed you two haven't noticed that bipedal, octopus, 8 legs, squid, 10 legs, they're all multiples of two. So I pose the question, when you're looking at options, it has to be a multiple of two. That way you avoid the dilemma, but it's still, you're looking for one solution, which is a solution you can take action on, because you only, can only really take one action at a time.
So you're saying that we come up with things in pairs, or are you saying that it's still along a gradient?
Depends which way you're going. So if you're going towards the action, which is the solution, you're going from multiples, usually which are multiples of two as options, down, and then you go, okay, they get grouped into one group. And they get grouped, and then the groups are multiples, and they get grouped down, and then you come down to a single action that you can do. And if you go the other way, it's, okay, let's see how many options we have. You go from out, you go from one to two, and then from two to, say, 4 or 8 or 10 or 20, you follow?
So branching out or branching back in.
Yeah, so it's like the classic family tree. So depending whether you're going back in history or forward to you, it always branches off. And some branches drop and fall off. So, well, you know, to be
fair. That's some sort of sickness when limbs starts falling off.
Or it means you're a perfectly active male squid and you drop the tentacle off so you impregnate the female. So not all tentacles are created equal.
Everything comes back to the biology. No, but I think that it's interesting, because what I'm thinking all of a sudden is that even when we have sort of 3 or 5 or 7 ideas, we often end up with a bit of an idea tournament where we still end up weighing the things pairwise. We compare this thing to that thing, and then sort of we take the winner, and then sort of we do pairwise comparisons, and then we end up with, well, this seems to be the overall winner. That's our heuristic for going towards that, which sort of makes sense in a way.
Yeah. When I was thinking about it, I was trying to think biologically, what has 3 legs? What has 3 arms? I couldn't think of anything with 3, and the only thing I thought of that had 3 is earthworms have 3 lips.
some starfish have got like 5 legs, haven't they?
Yes, true. But they're symmetrical. So it's sort of like, but it's very hard to think of something. And if you think of an animal, think, okay, well, they've got 2 legs. They've got 2 legs, 2 arms, but they have a prehensile tail often. So the third thing isn't actually a leg or an arm. It's something else that can function like that if it need be. If you try and look through that lens, that side of it, That's why I thought everything sort of, you know, it's a good idea to start with everything's divided into two, but the twos are grouped into singular groups. Like, you usually find clusters that'll grow, okay, they're that group, and they're that group, and they're that group. And then you do the tournament of where they belong, which is like the battle of left and right, or the battle of,
So,
light and dark.
So I'm going to circle back to the tournament idea, because it's sort of one against another. And I'm wondering if that's also biased because, you know, we've got two limbs. If we were an octopus society, would tournaments be eight against each other, so one against seven?
No. I think that's interesting.
No, the answer is no. Because the survival instinct would be in a group of three or even five. There'll always be multiple that will hold back, let the other two stronger ones beat the crap out of each other, and therefore then he's weakened, and then the other three or four would jump in and kill him. Welcome to evolution.
So if we're going all evolutionary on this, I think that there's a compelling argument to be made for the odd here, for the threes and keeping balance. Because if we actually take the tail into account, that's usually a balancing mechanism for those that are fortunate enough to have one, I suppose. So that's a nice thing. When we have sort of a symmetrical view and sort of when we have these two sides, we often have a balancing thing. Even animals ends up being three-legged stools in a way, except with sort of four legs and then sort of something to keep balance.
All right.
Makes for a good cat and sort of good apes, I suppose.
Toby, I'm going to play with your mind now. Ready? in the realm of bonsai, and this sounds counterintuitive, but bonsai will always be little trees potted up in odd numbers. And the irony of that is the odd number, one, three, five, from different angles, it always looks symmetrical. If you have two items and you rotate around it, the image doesn't stay symmetrical all the time. So the odds give you symmetry from all perspectives.
Mm.
How's that?
Yeah, and we know that a three-legged stool is more stable than a four-legged one, or it's easier to make it stable in many circumstances. And if we look at engineering, it's very common to use triangles for the same reason. Sort of rounded arches can carry a lot of weight. Triangles also have some very useful properties in how they distribute force.
So where's this going? This is going to coming up with ideas. I think it's very easy. I think we've got a bias, as I said earlier, to saying I've got one option and I've got the opposite option. I've got one hand or the other hand. And I think what we're saying in this conversation is it would be more useful to think in slightly different ways to overcome that bias. And I do like the idea of coming up with things in odd numbers. And I don't know how it's useful to be symmetrical from observing from the outside, but it feels nice. And I'm not, yeah, so I think that would be a good thing to do, come up with an odd number of ideas.
Well, the thing of odds in bonsai, when you do bonsai, is that when you rotate a pot, because as you're growing the plant, you need to bear in mind where the sun is because it will tend to draw the plant towards it. So to get the symmetry when you rotate the pot, it takes away the importance of perspective. It presents a common view. Even though it's different as you rotate it, it still gives you a sense of balance, perceived balance. So when you have, you know, on-off as the options, instead of like a three-position switch that has in the middle, so on for the left, off in the middle, and on for the right, that's a more balanced switch. You can use that in a lot more places than just a simple on-off.
So are we driving towards that what we tend to end up with, and we're currently postulating that it's because how we're actually made. We have sort of the dichotomies built into ourselves, that we have the right side and the left side, and sort of there's a bit of competition between them, but we sort of think on the one hand this, and on the other hand this. And then if we can transcend that a bit, and I think this takes a lot of effort, because this is sort of us having two hands, sort of that's what we are. And then we can sort of, we can shift into a mindset of symmetry in art and sort of go, well, let's sort of have a set bonsai think this thing, sort of. It's not symmetrical, but it sort of, it has the same structure, and that gives raised a certain set of, a certain aesthetic in itself. And then at sort of some point, if we can transcend that, then there's octopus thinking. But how would you even practice octopus thinking? How would you put yourself in that frame?
I think it's a provoking approach. So to say, let's assume that we're biased and it's easy to come up with two ideas and that it's probably difficult to come up with eight ideas, and let's just force ourselves to do it. So I've spoken before about when you've got a template and a few boxes and some headings in them, it drives a different sort of conversation to compared to one where you're just sort of speaking to people and asking them questions. You can ask quite provocative questions if it's in a box on a template. So that's what I'm thinking, is where we're looking for a range of ideas, a range of options, then forcing ourselves to go to what seems quite silly amount, going to the eight different ideas instead of two or three, I think that's where it would be useful.
So using the putting all the tentacles on the octopus in a way as a enabling constraint for creativity, that sort of, unless we can come up with these many reasonable options, we probably have work left to do.
Yeah, we haven't explored far enough. So it's a way of as you say, an enabling constraint. We're not saying come up with 100, but if we can come up with 100, that's good as well. But I think eight is more useful than where we normally think.
So if I have a bias for thinking in threes as the bonsai, does that make me triest?
Triest instead of biased. Yes.
Yes, but are all the legs of your tripod the same length? We tend to go, we think forward, reverse, front, back, because we're basically, we have a front, we have a back, we have left side, right side, everything's divided in two. So we tend to distill everything down into on, off, front, back. The irony is we tend to ignore, you know, null states, do nothing, stay still, you know. But we, even with fight and flight, you either stay still or you run away. The other one is you could move away slowly. Right, you could try and slide under slowly under something. Right, there is no, and then what's the level of fighting? Is it fight to evade, like a jet of ink from a squid, to distract and confuse and then go off in the other direction? So, because it's also the environment when you come to, like squid and octopus are in the water. If you've ever been diving and you've lost your dive buddy, the answer is look up over your head or look down. We're not used to things in three dimensions. So when you first dive, you can actually lose your dive buddy and then you go, oh. And you look up and there they are, a meter above me, right? But they're literally only a meter away, but you don't know they're there because their bubbles aren't, you know, if you were on top, you'd see their bubbles go up. But if you're underneath, you don't. So you're not used to the three-dimensional aspect.
Mm. Yeah, and we're not thinking that way. So what fight, fright, flight. Yeah, I like the sort of, we also have sort of fright as sort of being paralyzed and standing still.
Well, that's the possum, you know, the opossum, like over their heads, you know, you just paralyze and you act, play dead, right? Fright. Fear.
And from experience, I think that's actually more common than people actually running away. It's freezing in place.
Yeah.
So there's something about that metaphor. But I like that. I haven't dived myself, but but I can get that sense of sort of we're not used to orienting in these additional dimensions. And hence, of course, you can lose someone sort of just because they're in a blind spot for you.
Yes.
And it also seems like that's how we tend to view the world in terms of sort of we need to push forward in a sense, or we need to sort of push off from this, that we sort of think of force as a vector in a singular plane, probably because we don't have that many things to push with. And also, of course, for reasons of if you concentrate the force in a singular direction, it acts as a force multiplier. There's something in that.
Yeah, I'm also thinking, you know, when you're watching a movie and the goodie or the baddie has gone to hide in the rafters on the roof, because, of course, most of us, when we walk into a building, don't look up. Well, at least in movies, we don't. So I think even not in the water, we still have those blind spots. And what I like about that sort of three-dimensional scanning, when we go, let's scan for ideas, are we thinking in only two dimensions or are we thinking in three dimensions is, I think, a really good question to ask as well.
Definitely. And to a certain degree, I think that this very much probably relates to how we think about processes and how we think about this sort of this search for almost one-dimensional answers. This is sort of, this is the way, rather than actually trying to break down the dichotomy and going, well, there's an additional dimension. Sort of, are we watching the roof? I think that's sort of where we entered other domains, where we sort of, where the can of worms actually, what it is essentially that. We need to add additional dimensions to the thinking. We need to sort of go, well, this stool has multiple legs and they might be of different length and they might be pushing with different forces in different directions, and figuring out where we end up becomes way more complicated for us. And we sort of, we're not really wired for that kind of thinking. And so I think that's, there's a connection between those two.
In decision making, the third dimension to me in a decision making sort of event is actually context of the environment. Because when you tend to make a decision, you're laser focusing on the thing you want to make a decision about. You're just completely focused. It's like someone reading a book and they ignore the entire world around them, and someone can come up and scare the absolute crap out of them because they didn't even see them coming up in their blind, you know, in the peripheral vision. They're just so focused. And that's what I see decision making. We tend to do that because we focus on what we see as the goal. But when you have the third dimension, that's how it all fits in. Like, where does that decision fit in the production line? Where does it fit in the company's overarching goals? We tend to ignore the bigger picture to make the quick decision or action, actually.
Ooh, I like that. And it also reminds me about, so one of the key things I tend to talk about when I talk about software with often young software engineers, but a whole lot of people get this completely wrong, is that most of the people entering the field from a solving problems perspective, and that's most of us that have studied computer science, we go in with a mindset of, on the one hand, we have the problem to be solved. And in the other hand, well, we have all the knowledge and all the algorithms and the things that constitute the solution to this problem. So that there's our two dimensions. On the one hand, we have the problem. On the other hand, we have the solution. And what we think about our job as is creating, sort of manifesting, implementing the solution to the problem so we have the problem solved. This makes a whole lot of sense to a lot of people. The problem is that, of course, it's entirely wrong because there's this missing dimension that we fail to take into account. And this is why we so often end up with the wrong solutions at the wrong time, because we ignore time. We ignore the fact that both of these two things are traveling through time. So what we're not searching for, a point in time solution to a problem, we're actually modulating a timeline where a partial solution at some time have a different effect than the full solution at some later date. And just introducing that timed aspect is often the frame that's missing to understand a lot of what we consider more modern practices, like continuous delivery, refactoring, and all of these things. Why is the traditional idea of clearly stating the problem, clearly defining the correct solution, and then executing on it, why that is wrongheaded? It's because that missing dimension, which seems to me to be the same thinking. We had two dimensions that we focused on, and that made us miss the third one. And the third one is actually the one that we can't get away from, because reality is time-based in a sense.
All right, I'm playing with you again. So if I look at it this way, let's take it into another sort of, you have facts. So you have facts, knowledge, and wisdom. Okay, so you just have the raw data. You can look it up in a book, it's in a table, that's a fact, right? Then you have the knowledge, that's the information you're carrying with you that you know and you can easily access. And then you have the wisdom, which is knowing when that knowledge is appropriate to use and how much to use and when. Three very important things. However, you've also got to remember that if you have a time constraint or an urgency or an emergency, you need to focus into the yes, no, action, reaction model, because you need the answer immediately. So you don't have time to look at it in the grander scheme of things. You've got to react instantly. It has to be immediate.
It's also
data is having a red tomato. Knowledge is knowing that it's a fruit.
Correct.
And wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad.
Yes, basically.
I like that.
Right? But we confuse a lot of words like knowledge and wisdom. We think they're interchangeable. They're not. It's like maturity. You know, just because you're chronologically old doesn't mean you're mature. it's like, you know, oh, look, my birthday. I got more maturity now. It doesn't work that way.
So what I'm thinking about is it's very easy to simplistically go, I need to make decision X. So there's the decision. In order to make that decision, I need these inputs. I need these pieces of information. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Fabulous. And that's all you think there is to it. But what I'm hearing here is we need to take into consideration other contextual things, one of which is time, because there are probably other contextual things as well. So I'm going to make decision X. What impact will that decision have depending on the time, and what kind of feedback will I get about that decision over what time frame? And then all of the inputs for that decision, A, B, C, D, E, are they also time dependent? Toby, I really liked that talk you did ages ago about data for decision making is ephemeral. Yeah, so it expires. It has an expiry date. Sometimes it's fairly constant and other times it's very fleeting.
Another thing you should consider is that if you look at how we mark age, you're 25, you're 26, but you're 25 or 26 for the entire year. So it's like it's like you only mark off points. If you do any audio recording, you know that the bit rates, right, and the bytes that you record has gone up gradually over time. But the tinier slices you take, the more analog sounding it becomes. The higher sample rates, the more close to the analog world it becomes.
Mm.
But I find it amusing that we log time in, like, from your birthday. It's like, you're 50 for the entire year, or you're 25 for the entire year. So it's like time stops for you somehow. And I think we do that same thing with decisions. Once we make a decision, we push it aside and we don't look at it again until something bad happens, or it's an anniversary or a milestone comes up.
So how can we start to anticipate things like what impact a decision might have?
Ooh, this is one of those topics that I think has become actually harder over time, because it gets conflated with something else that we've decided is a very, very bad thing. And that's, of course, is guesstimation or any sort of prediction. And I think that what we lost in that is exactly what you're talking about. Having an anticipation is the way to sort of gauge the result of the decision and the robustness of our mental model around the thing. And our reluctance these days to even consider that as a worthwhile activity, I think that's something that is actively harmful for us. We espouse a want for learning, but if we really wanted to learn, then we would be very keen on extracting as much information as we could from an outcome. But that would actually require us to forecast, not to control, but to learn. And I think this is one of those key distinctions that I think get lost a whole lot of times, that I really dislike the forecasting in order to trying to control or making the forecasts a target. But I'm a huge fan of running simulations in your head and trying to anticipate what will happen, not because it makes you able to predict the future, but it makes you slightly better at understanding the dynamics. And I think that's one of the key takeaways in the High Velocity Edge, also in Stephen Spear's books.
I'm very glad you mentioned dynamics. I have a pet peeve, and my pet peeve is everyone likes blasting out statistics and they keep forgetting the error bars. It annoys the absolute crap out of me, because we have this habit of, once we get a number, 96%, you know, or 6% or whatever. To me, 6%, okay. What's the error bars? What's the error in that number?
Mm.
How many times have you heard someone ask, when they get data, what's the error margin of error? Never? Yeah, see? Pet peeve.
Yeah. Well, sort of. You can't even get an estimate in ranges these days, so sort of it's a number, that's what it is, which of course is problematic. But I like that question, Kim. How do we get back to anticipation? How do we make it more than sort of pass-fail?
Yeah, and I mean, you have to know where you are to start with, right? And you need to have an idea of where you're going, and then you have to take the action and see what happens. So that to me is what we're trying to look at.
I think the reason we've gone into this is we have this fallacy that we're perfect. We won't say we're perfect, but we all think we are. Like, we're all above average. Yeah, go figure that one out. 100% of us are above average. Do the maths. But it just can't work. But we tend to, once we make a decision, we brainwash ourselves and everyone around us, oh, that's the right decision. We've lost that. I like your comfortable ambiguity. You've got to be comfortable with it being not perfect, slightly off, slightly asymmetrical, right? Because if you expect perfection, we're humans. We will fail. We can get close to it. We can strive towards it, but we'll never get there. And no one wants to get there because it's boring at that end. if you're perfect, it's like you're just frozen. There's nothing else to do. There's no chaos to remedy. There's no variation or sensory perception. It's like a sensor that's always, you know, either on or off. It's in a perfect state. There's no interaction like a noble gas in perfection. So you want to get close to it, but don't want to be there. So you have to try and go, I'm okay with chaos. I like chaos. Personally, I like chaos. A lot of good stuff comes out of chaos. But I'm not an anarchist. There's a difference. Huge difference, you know. To ride a wave, which is a chaotic event, doesn't mean you want to be thrown onto the coral reef, dumped on a reef when you're from a wave, right? It's just, you don't want that. Trust me, you don't want that, right? So if we have a decision, that's why the error bars are important to me, because it gives you that, it's not a perfect number. It's not a prime number. It's not beautiful and all balanced. It is, okay, give or take, you know, 1 or 0.0%, that's the number. So there's some built-in tolerance for slippage and wear. See, like in gears, wear over time.
What I'm super happy about is the application of the pattern easy analysis can of worms onto an estimate. So when you're trying to say how much will this piece of work take or cost, what we can do is we can use easy analysis can of worms as proxies for plus or minus 10%, plus or minus 30%, and plus or minus 100%, or as I like to call it, a wild guess, and do it like a stacked bar graph. Because the problem is, a lot of times when you go up and request funding for something, they want it to one level of certainty. So it might be plus or minus 30%, or it might be plus or minus 10%. But in reality, most of the things that we do are made up of components that vary in the level of uncertainty. So if I instead can go and I've even done it mathematically in an Excel spreadsheet, right, for a project. I did, you know, what is the stuff that I'm confident plus or minus 10? What's plus or minus 30? What's, you know, plus or minus 100, just to put a number on it? And then I added the numbers up according to the amount of money in it so that on average it was, I don't know what the number was, but it was, you know, 37.5% or whatever it was. And when you do that, if you're going to someone who's about to provide funding to you, if you can give them a sense of what is the wild guess component and where is their certainty, they can make a good decision about whether that project should proceed. Say, for example, the high certainty stuff is stuff that is worth doing anyway. Right? Well, and the wild guess really isn't here or there. Well, that's great. Just keep going. Get on with it. If, you know, what you've got high certainty around is, yeah, it's the base that's there, but the really interesting and important part is still in the wild guess territory, well, don't go off and spend everything and get it all done. Take a bit more time to explore that wild guess area first. So that's where people can start to make a lot better decisions. Instead of saying, give me a plus or minus 10% costing before I'll even think about giving you money, well, why don't we do this stacked bar graph way of doing it? That would be much better.
I think that's it's interesting because it relates to one of the things many years ago, while I still actually tried to educate people on story points rather than just educating them to not use them, I spoke to a client that they were in the gambling industry. And those are probably the only people that really understood this after explaining it. A tendency people have, of course, is to adding up the estimates or adding up the story points or adding up whatever audience you're using. But the thing is that you can't do addition on what is essentially probability distributions, or you can, but you can't do it as sort of, I'm adding one and one and that's the same as a two.
Yeah.
And the example I tried to give these people, and which was very, very intuitive for them because they worked with betting all day was essentially, well, you're doing this thing where you're sort of, you're just computing the sum of your story points for your teams. And then you're going, they have a velocity of blah, 100. And then sort of, but if you consider it like this instead, that you can either take a coin flip and sort of, you can take a coin flip where you win or lose $100, or you can have 100 coin flips, each worth a dollar. You don't even need to have a preference about which bet you'd rather take. They have this sort of same expected value, but of course they have very, very different dynamics. And they will feel very differently over time because you'll have very different variance, especially if you just look at it at the sprint review time, sort of that in one case, sort of if you have $100 bet and that's one coin flip and that's your sprint, then it will either be great or it will be horrible. Those are the only two outcomes. But with the $101 coin flips, then most sprints will be fairly similar. You'll have some outliers. There's a few probabilities, but the variation will be way lower, or sort of as a conceptual feeling, because you'll have aggregated all of these small probabilities. And I think that sort of that plays into this in a sense that usually we end up looking at these things at the wrong granularity. There's a fair amount of research that points to executives, high-level executives want their firms to take more risk than the firms usually actually end up taking. And the reason being that as a high-level executive, you want people to place aggressive bets because you know that that's where usually the large payoffs are. And you sort of, you know, it's okay for a few of them to fail because you're looking at the portfolio level. But for an individual manager, sort of, since we tend to confuse failure with fault, you know that being risk averse is actually the more stable strategy to keep your position or to advance. So since I'm responsible for a bet, I will be conservative because that's the only sensible strategy in most environments. But one level up would actually want people to take more risks. So you end up actually with this great tension. I think we have that in a lot of places, that since we don't quantify the risks and we don't talk about sort of how do we aggregate them up and what's the difference between failure and fault, we end up in this super odd situation where we're actually not getting what we want and we're not being within sensible margins at all. And we're not even aware of that this is what's going on. And I think that's also sort of goes towards your point of anticipation. If we don't sort of try to call our shots at a very low level, if I sort of totally refuse to think about how long one of my things might take, I also actually rob myself of the opportunity to learn where my assumptions were off and where my current capabilities and our current joint capacity, what it actually is. So it actually robs us of information we need to actually learn.
I have a couple of little things I've teased out of that. To use the $100 coin toss, $100 bet on heads or tails, you have a 50% chance of winning, right? Or losing. Now, if the goal was to win $100 and you do 100 coin tosses, each for a dollar, you have to win $100, get 100 tosses all turn up the way you call them.
Yep.
Not going to happen.
This is also a lot of these things might be, if luck is your only viable strategy, then by all means take the big coin toss, and if you win, cash out and run.
That's exactly right.
And if you lose, well, blame someone else and get more venture capital.
But in the beginning of this, I was actually thinking most decisions, even the ones that have like 100% error bars, like they're right out there. We don't usually do that, because even those ones that are really left field, way out their decisions, a good percentage of that decision is pretty well known. It's only a small component that throws it out left field.
Sometimes it throws it way out.
Yeah. So if you start thinking, that's where the loading comes in when you're doing a coin toss. That's why when you're gambling, they have to make it like doing Tats Lotto numbers. They have to load it in your advantage. That's why it's a huge jackpot. So as you go on, taking more and more risks. But I was actually thinking most people, if you look at the 10% margin of error or the 30%, The 10%, when we make a decision, we tend to make decisions that we feel very comfortable with, and we consider we can have a low margin of error because we're experienced in that area, that sort of stuff. And then the ones that get bigger ones are the ones we're not really experienced. That's where the experts come in, or you ask a friend. But the ones that are like so far left field are like, you know, is an asteroid going to hit the Earth sort of thing. They're way off left field. But even on those, to be able to work that out, you still need stairs, little steps made up of well-known outcomes.
And I think that, so Tom DeMarco published an essay many, many years ago that a lot of people tend to reference on this subject of when does estimation matter? And the sort of the TLDR of it is, of course, that estimates and the precision of estimates matter a whole lot when the things you're doing doesn't have significant enough return on investment. So you need to have very precise estimates to know if you're supposed to go ahead with a thing that might net you a 1%, 2%, or 5% improvement. But if the return of the benefit of succeeding is big enough, then sort of being within 5%, 10%, 15%, 50%, 100%, or even 1,000% on the cost equation doesn't matter that much. So the sort of the more important the thing you're doing is, the less important the estimates become, is sort of the central thesis of that. And I think that gets we take that one up a lot. And there's some really good points in it, because I think that what it actually is telling us is the contextual bit here, that when you're doing new product development, when everything is sort of unknown, then sort of having tight cost control might be less important. If you're in Genesis, if you're doing new product development, you're trying to buy knowledge, and being off by a factor of something on a probably fairly small amount of money anyway, isn't that big of a deal. But as you sort of go into more commoditized ways of working or businesses, or when the scale actually drastically increases, both the investment and the payoff, sort of the investment is way, way bigger, but the payoff also is relatively smaller. It might be big in absolute terms, but sort of as a percentage of total operating expenses might be smaller. Then actually being better at anticipating cost is way more important, because it sort of that predicts if you actually is ever going to make the money back, or if it's sort of if it's a project that's dead in the waters already. So I think that there's also that to it. And I think that overall, we're reluctant to take a lot of good bets. We talk a lot about that we should be taking chances, but most of us are risk averse.
Yeah, no, that's for good reason. It's called evolution. It is literally life or death. We've been programmed that way to be risk averse, right? I'm just wondering, like, if you look at the high-level stuff, like a high-level manager, and it's a very granular, pixelated image, and they can see, and therefore they've got a big arcing look at it, overarching look, you would almost assume that on the big scale of things, they should be more risk-embracing. Yet, they have the problem that they could lose everyone's job. It's sort of a paradox. Like, with the more information you have, you think you could make better decisions, but with the more information you have, you tend to have more responsibility for others. Therefore, you would avoid making decisions that could impact many things. You see the paradox? You see how it's sort of backwards? Like, when you've got all this information, you could make a well-informed decision. That decision can also impact a lot of things down the line, and therefore you tend to avoid making those sort of decisions.
That comes back to another theory of mine. So another theory I have is that we've muddled together information flows and people management. So basically, if you could have two different hierarchies, the hierarchy of information flow and the hierarchy of people management, if those two roles could be separated out, then the people management could just get on with what they're doing and the information flows would do the decisions like you're talking about. But that's not reality. Normally, a person who manages other people or is in a leadership role has both things, has the access to the information and also responsibility for people's roles.
When you're working in a company and you move up, you're not just responsible for your own choices. Your choices impact many people. Mm. So the higher you go up, the burden of management gets heavier and heavier until it basically can paralyze you from making a decision, because who wants 10,000 people to lose their job?
Yeah, I think this tension is what actually, to a certain degree, drives the tendency for... So we tend to dehumanize managers, especially those that are high up in the hierarchy and at a different location, because we blame them for sort of not considering the human aspects and simply managing the firm on the numbers. Which inadvertently seems to be what we're proposing over here, is that sort of just make the right decisions, don't manage the people. And I think that that's actually, since there's a limit to how much information we can integrate, and since some people actually end up thinking that, well, my prime responsibility is managing the firm for most of us. And I think this is a tension that probably a lot of people have felt during the economically stressful times that has been, that sort of you need to make decisions on the livelihood of your company and those within it. And you need to sort of, how do you balance these different forces? So I think that's it's interesting because we obviously have limits on how much information we can integrate. So there's cognitive limits, and then you're responsible for people's jobs. And I think that's, the closer you are to the people, the more you usually, you see that, you see all the nuance. And the further you move away from it, the more you start thinking strategically about it. But that also, to a certain degree, makes every individual a lesser concern, and the whole becomes sort of a greater concern. But that also is sort of, it becomes icky in a bit. It's hard to think about, because you want to both be compassionate, but you also need to be rational.
We're missing another tangent. Like, I don't believe the man on the production line, or the female person, like the lowly employee, the guy cleaning the floors, man, woman, child, whatever, if you're in China, on the production line, that person is still responsible and doesn't get a free pass by saying it's management's responsibility. Because say you're working a production line and you need to scratch your nose and the bottles are going past. It's up to you to decide whether you have enough time to scratch your nose and still do what you have to do in the production line, right? You should be aware of that. You can't expect a manager to be responsible for your well-being. That's that victimhood thing. I don't like that whole, you know, I'm not responsible for my own decisions. So yes, the manager, as you go higher and higher up, they're more reluctant to take risks that could impact, you know, 10,000 employees, but the employees also have to be able to take responsibility for the reports and their behavior and sending messages up so the manager can make good decisions. It's not like you can just handball the ball over to the manager and say, well, you cost it, you know, all these people their jobs. Well, you know, if everyone's taking smokos and not doing the work, how can they sell products if you're not making them at the factory floor? You've got to... My dad's grandmother, all right, my dad's 80 plus. His grandmother, when he started work, she said, when you go work for the boss, you have to earn enough money for you for the day and the boss for the day, the same amount. Otherwise, why would he keep you? And people at the worker level, the lower level, seem not to understand that. And managers also don't understand that if you just sack people. I had a manager once say to me, if I can save the company $100,000, I can ask for a $10,000 pay rise next year.
And that's basically one headcount.
And I'm just looking at him going, okay, so you fire, say, 10 people to, you know, or whatever, fire someone to save them $100,000 so you can get an extra $10,000 in your pay packet. How narrow-minded is that? I mean, you might as well just slit the person's throat. You've killed their family, you know. All right, if they're inept or whatever, fair enough. But to actually come out and say, so I can get more money in my pocket, I will throw someone under the bus, right? That's wrong. But it's also wrong the other way around. If I work really slowly and don't meet my quota, I can come back on Saturday and Sunday with payloading and get double time and triple time. I've seen that in factories too. They do nothing all week and they all want to work Saturday and Sunday because they get double and triple pay. That's wrong too. And then they wonder why the factory's now gone. All right? There's got to be responsibility all through the board, and that's what we tend to avoid in decision making, the responsibility.
So we started with one hand or the other and octopus thinking. And we ended up with decision making, and we've meandered a merry path.
Yeah, but that
through many topics.
The decision making and management still works, because you have a low tier worker, production line, and you have management. You can say top management tier, it doesn't matter. That's left, right, front, back. And then you've got the dimension of perspective over responsibilities. Well, you could say transparency, but really responsibility. If you're working on the factory floor and there's a puddle of oil, and you see someone walking towards it or driving a forklift towards it, wouldn't you stop the person before they skid and hurt someone or kill themselves? Right? Wouldn't you draw attention to the potential problem? That's the responsibility part. It's a very us and them, which is the left and right, black and white thing, on off. It's not combative. Life is not meant to be combative unless you're in a gladiator ring, and fair enough. But it's not that. Most life isn't like that. It's like saying, what was it? If I kill someone today, I was 99.99% mostly peaceful. Because the rest of my life, I didn't kill anyone. I just killed them today, right? But I'm still a murderer.
There's a slight, yeah, there's a slight asymmetry in that. What I actually has realized is that there's a connection in this to the octopus thinking. Let me see if I can explain it so it actually makes sense to anyone else. But when we start talking about hierarchy, especially traditional hierarchies, right? We talk about sort of up and down the hierarchy, the sort of that becomes our left and right. Well, we're humans. We're very self-centered. I have my head in the middle, and then I have my left and right. So I got myself, and then I got up the hierarchy, and I got down the hierarchy. And that's how we've been thinking about things for a very long time. But if we look at more modern ways to organize, when we start thinking about, when we look into sociocracy and these other more distributed models, when you end up with sort of circles of interest, or just to use another, when we start thinking about two pizza teams or microservices or essentially any networked organization, so matrices sort of play into this to a certain, but when we start thinking about that instead of having a pyramid shape, we actually end up in multiple collaborations. We're actually adding additional dimensions to our interaction patterns and to our decision making. So that seems to be us evolving extra tentacles. And this might be why those structures are both so actually useful and sort of powerful, but also feel so strange to us, because we're trying to add sort of additional dimensions to our thinking. And it takes a while getting used to thinking like an octopus.
I'm sorry, I got sidetracked thinking about beehive architecture.
Tell me about beehives.
Well, because I can't remember whether it's a pentagon shape or an octagon. It doesn't matter, but let's assume a pentagon. The beehives work on every wall of the chamber is also a wall of the chamber next to it. So it gives incredible strength, minimum use of materials, and maximum volume. It's sort of like if someone says, okay, let's get a box of apples. They're round. There's a lot of space in between them. So they say, let's put the product in a box. So it's square, but there's still space around the squares. It's not perfectly, it's not structurally strong because it has long sides and tall sides, and so they can deflect more. But when you look at a beehive, have you looked it up, Kim?
I'm in process of looking it up.
All right. I think it's an octagon or a hexagon. So you've got five sides, like the pentagon, right? So if you make five sides and then you draw another five-sided figure off that side, one of the sides, you end up not needing as much material to make a very large, voluminous container.
I think it's six-sided.
Six-sided?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. Since partly by mistake, partly by layout reasons, but also because it made sense, I've actually wound up with a hexagonal architecture of our organization, because it turned out that was having those five or six walls. Not all of them are relevant for every team, but most teams had sort of adjacent teams for three or four of those hexagons. And it gives you both a value stream. It's slightly wobbly, but sort of it goes in a direction. But you can see sort of how teams interrelate across the value stream, but they also have more than just an upstream and a downstream. So hexagons work for that regard too. So that's an interesting accident.
You could say a wall, it could be a single wall, which is a circle, like a tube. Or you could say a bi-wall, like two walls, but you have to make a box, so there's two of them, so you've got four. And then you've got a triangular shape could be your wall, so three walls. And then you could use that wall to be, and it'll give more strength because it's working in not just forward, back, left, right directions. It's got cross-bracing properties to it. And then you've got the pentagon shape, and then you've got the hex. So those extra facets of walls contribute not necessarily in one direction more strength or stability, but overall the structure becomes more stable and has greater stability in it.
So the hexagon is the strongest shape known Not many people know this, but if you want something to hold a lot of weight, pick a hexagon.
There you go. So there you go. That's your management decision process, should be on a hexagon.
Mm-hmm.
How's that? We pass down the message from on high.
There you go. So we started off with we think one thing or the other, and maybe we should think like an octopus for coming up with many ideas. And now we're kind of going down to six sides for strength, which is a different perspective. Which,
strangely enough, is an insect. Legs.
There you go. So it's
all we'll need to work on the branding. I don't think the wisdom of bees gonna fly.
Well, I mean, an octopus, an eight-legged, is a spider. Right? So insects tend to have six. Bugs. The buggy idea.
Mm.
But yeah. But no, it's
buggy management. That sounds like
a lot of people don't realize that different perspectives, although it puts more of a conscious load on you when you're making a decision, it's not a burden. It actually prevents a lot of upcoming issues. If you can, it's like if you're building a house and you pour concrete and you can't be bothered taking the grass and stuff off, and you pour the concrete on top of that, then the biological material will rot and collapse. And your concrete will crack. So because you don't want to make the decision, should we take the grass away before we pour the slab and blah, 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 should we put gravel? By avoiding having a look at, well, are we building on sand? Well, sand's got good drainage and it's pretty stable, sort of like Western Australia here in Australia. So you don't need a very thick concrete slab. But if you're building on clay, which expands and contracts with moisture content, and you've got like a tree has fallen down and it's been buried over, and you build on top of it, not a good idea because it'll rot and make the center of your house or a wall will fall out because it'll just collapse. So if you look at it from more than one perspective, it actually makes a more robust decision. And it really doesn't take that much more time because you don't actually have to calibrate it into the answer. You have to be aware of it. And once you're aware, then you can weigh how much risk you want to take. Make any sense?
I think we're reaching a natural endpoint.
I think Toby's gone to sleep.
I'm just considering all the viewpoints.
No, he's
got I'm for all my extra arms.
He's got, his hexadecimal glasses on. He's peering through the hexadecimal. Hey, you're a programmer. Hexadecimal. There you go.
That's a wrap.
I think that's a wrap.
Awesome.
We meandered all over that, you know, then.
I think that the only common theme was numbers.
Great table. Numbers.
Numbers.
All of them.
Yep.